This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Graceworks Pictures Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife Heather. Indivisible, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters October 26th, more information is available at indivisiblemovie.com.
This is Janet Meffer Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Meffer.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us again. I have to say, I am a little confused about this civility issue. Maybe you're as confused as I am, because on the one hand, we have people in politics on the left who say that when they bring a knife to the fight, you bring a gun. It's not when they go low, we go high anymore. It is we kick them, according to the former Attorney General Eric Holder. We have Steve Scalise getting shot and Democrats not saying very much about the fact that a leftist shot him at a congressional baseball game. We have Maxine Waters, the congresswoman, talking about all the mayhem that you should cause. We have leftists at the Women's March who talk about blowing up the White House. How much incredibly over-the-top uncivil rhetoric have we seen from the left since President Trump was elected, and even before that, but especially since President Trump was elected? It's very hard to remember every incident because there have been so many incidents. And yet, now that we have this bomb scare that has occurred regarding a number of Democratic politicians, all of a sudden, the whole tune has changed. And I want to go to some of these cuts that we have here on what's going on with this bomb scare. And of course, nobody wants anybody to get hurt. CNN received mail bombs and all, some of these others, George Soros and the Clintons. Nobody was hurt, thankfully. Nobody wants anybody to be hurt. But now you have this whole new call for civility. And because there is not enough civility, whose fault do you think it is? Let's listen to the women of The View. This is cut one.
I don't know. And, you know, I was been texting with my former colleagues at CNN, and they're scared. And one colleague, former colleague, said, this is what happened when the president calls you the enemy of the people.
That's right.
And I thought, my gosh, you know, the tone is coming from the top. And now CNN has become a target. Journalists that are simply trying to do their
job. But we still don't know anything yet about where this is coming from and what the motive is and who the person or the people are behind it. So it's important just be careful because we don't know yet. But in general,
why did CNN get the bomb?
You know, so to be Sherlock Holmes.
And the Obamas. Fox News hasn't gotten a bomb yet.
But we don't know if they got it.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. It's so vapid, isn't it? It's Trump's fault. It's Trump's fault that all of this is going on with no evidence, with no proof, with no facts, with no federal investigation reaching a conclusion of any kind. The women on The View have it all figured out. It's Trump's fault that CNN got a bomb in the mail, because why is that? He has talked about the press as the enemy of the people, and that inspired some faux mail bomb sender whose identity nobody has uncovered yet to send a fake mail bomb or a mail bomb that didn't go off to CNN. Nothing like throwing around your opinions with absolutely no proof. There used to be, it seems to me, a little bit more caution from people who are on the air, whether it's TV or radio, that you recognize. You don't just start throwing stuff out there and accusing people of things when you have no facts to back it up. But that doesn't matter, because it's about entertainment, you see, and leaving out all of the good parts. What led up to Trump getting mad at CNN? And by the way, it wasn't just President Trump getting mad at CNN. It was millions of American people getting mad at CNN for their shenanigans in the name of journalism that was the most irresponsible type of journalism, airing Democratic talking points, working in conjunction with the DNC. Must I go through all of the background on what led up to President Trump referring to CNN as fake news? How many times do we have to go through this? Do you want to go back to the Project Veritas videos, interviewing some of the producers at CNN? I really don't have to walk through that all again, I'm sure, because you're intelligent. You know all of this stuff already. But it's all robbed of any context. So let's continue to listen to the women of The View. This is cut two.
The country is only good as its people. And yeah. This is a time when I do think leadership does matter. And a role of a president, I think what's so important about it is being a unifier and finding you're not the president of one party or the other. You are the president of the United States.
Well, will he come out and denounce what's going on?
I wonder about that.
He'll blame it on somebody. He'll blame it on one of his
enemies. I keep saying, I gave up on this a long time ago. I gave up trying to let him lead and unify us. Fine. So the ladies of the view will do it. We look like we're on a ticket together as it is anyway. Right here in our outfit today.
But he should.
There's so many things he should be doing and he should have done. Yeah. He shouldn't be attacking Gold Star.
I'm hearing the White House has denounced it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Good.
Now, Tom.
Well, then I say great. It's not just him, though. Every time he says things like the press is the enemy of the people, mm-hmm. his entire party needs to stand up against him and say something. Mitch McConnell, where is he?
Oh, I'll tell you where he is, Joy. He's sitting in a restaurant getting heckled by a leftist while he's sitting there with his wife trying to have a meal. That's what's happening to Mitch McConnell. That's what Mitch McConnell is up to. Kind of like Senator Ted Cruz trying to have a nice meal in a restaurant and getting heckled by a bunch of leftists. Were you complaining about that on The View, Joy Behar? Because I don't remember that segment. Perhaps it was there and we all just missed it. But somehow I doubt that. That's where Mitch McConnell is. See, this is what I'm talking about. When you mention the word civility, they want civility and they want denouncing of violence or potential violence. Were they calling for the left to do that after Steve Scalise was shot with the same vigor? Again, perhaps there's some archive of Joy Behar going to town for the right. I don't recall anything like that ever taking place. So Trump did come out. President Trump called for unity and pledged to spare no expenses to bring those responsible for these despicable acts to justice. And he added, I want to say at these times we have to unify and send one very clear and strong message that acts of political violence of any kind have no place in the United States of America. So what do you think the reaction is among the media? Well, let's listen to David Gregory. This is Cut 3.
But what leaves me wanting, like Kerry, is you find yourself saying, I just wish he could have said some other things. You know, in the context of CNN being targeted here as well, in the context of so much animus that he himself has against CNN and other news outlets, to make a point about the fact that violence directed toward the news media is unacceptable. I mean, a high-profile journalist was just murdered in Turkey by the Saudis, who was working for the Washington Post. We've been talking about this. He's been talking about it for the past 2 weeks. It's imperative that he says that. Again, I come up wanting. I wish this is a president who could say, look, this is a tough time. We are after each other with very tough things to say about each other and about the direction of the country. But this is different. This is a level of violence that cannot be tolerated. It's an attack on all of us, and we have to see it that way. He just doesn't seem to be able to go that far.
Oh, my word. Oh, my word. The bomb didn't go off, by the way. Nobody was hurt. Nobody was killed, unlike Steve Scalise, who was hurt, who was shot, who could have been killed. And what of that? Did David Gregory have a diatribe against the Democratic politicians who didn't say exactly what they should have said at the time of that attempted assassination and just kind of moved on quickly because the assassin, would-be assassin, was a leftist? These people are such unbelievable hypocrites. We want Trump to denounce violence. We want Trump to call for unity. And Trump does it. And then their complaint is he didn't do it right. What would have satisfied you? There were these mail bombs sent not just to CNN. Also sent to George Soros and sent to Barack Obama and sent to the Clintons and sent to Eric Holder, according to the FBI. So it wasn't just a media directed attack. It wasn't a media directed incident at all. They were one of a series of recipients of these bombs. And so nobody was hurt. Nobody was killed. We're all grateful for that. But even when President Trump denounces it, it's not good enough because he didn't single out CNN and grovel in front of CNN and say it's all my fault. And had he done that, do you think they would have forgiven him? Literally, there's nothing that he could do that would satisfy these people. And that's part of the problem. And that leads me to ask the question, who is really being the side that is demonstrating incivility? And I would say it's not the right. I would say it's the left, and I think we can prove that. And we're going to come back on Janet Mefford today. A lot more to come, so stay with us.
From Graceworks Pictures comes Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife, Heather.
It is with great honor that I have served my country, but I only stand before you today because Jesus is my rock and because I have a family who loves and believes in me.
One marriage, one family, under God, Indivisible. Rated PG-13. May be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters October 26th. More information is available at indivisiblemovie.com.
Over a million refugees are in Lebanon today, and most of them are children. But through Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, these children are getting a Christian education and meals and believing in Jesus for the first time. What a ministry in such a dark part of the world. Can you help us continue the work? When you call 866-485-9187 with a gift of $22, you'll help rescue four of these children. Please call now, 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. We are back on Janet Mefford today. So good to have you with us. I was reading through Psalm 33. Such a great psalm. All the psalms are great, of course. But you think of this very well-known verse in verse 12. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people he chose for his inheritance. From heaven the Lord looks down and sees all mankind. From his dwelling place he watches all who live on earth. He who forms the hearts of all, who considers everything they do. No king is saved by the size of his army. No warrior escapes by his great strength. A horse is a vain hope for deliverance. Despite all its great strength, it cannot save. But the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear him, on those whose hope is in his unfailing love to deliver them from death and keep them alive in famine. We wait in hope for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. In him our hearts rejoice, for we trust in his holy name. May your unfailing love be with us, Lord, even as we put our hope in you. I read the whole thing because right before that it says the Lord foils the plans of the nations. He thwarts the purposes of the peoples, but the plans of the Lord stand firm forever, the purposes of his heart through all generations. The Lord is the Lord of the nations, is he not? We don't like to talk about that anymore because we're in a post-prayer in schools world. It's not the 60s anymore. We're cool. We've been thoroughly ACLU'd. You get the prayer out of the public schools and you get the monuments of the Ten Commandments out of public life and you make sure that you get rid of any vestige of Christianity from public display, get those nativity scenes off your city hall's front lawn, on and on and on and on and on. And we have thoroughly convinced ourselves that we are just one big secular nation. But the problem with that is when you turn yourself into some kind of faux secular nation, which is a joke because ultimately eternity is in our hearts, isn't it? And the mankind, all of us, male, female, we all have eternity in our hearts. And so we're all seeking to fill that God-shaped hole that is so often spoken about. And we can't do that with secularism. We can't do it with politics. We can't do it with progressivism. We can't do it with the sexual revolution. Only the Lord can fill that God-shaped hole in our hearts. Only he is mighty to save us. And we are dumb. I really want to use that word because it's really important to stress. We're really dumb if we think that we can continue on as a nation if we are going to reject the Lord of all the nations. This is a country that has been so blessed in so many ways over 240 some years. And we have in many ways forgotten God and shoved him aside and acted as if he doesn't matter and acted as if we can pay attention to him maybe on a couple of holidays throughout the year, maybe Easter, maybe Christmas. But other than that, you don't want to get too religious because that's just nuts. You don't want to go over the top with this stuff. You know, you want to be reasonable about your religion. You don't really want to go crazy. Where has that gotten us? Where has that gotten us? Absolutely nowhere. And when you look at how the country is falling apart in so many ways, you have such division in the country. And I could spend all day pointing fingers and say it's this person, it's that person. And I believe that. But ultimately, I think what's important to note is you can't really have true unity when you have rejected God. Ultimately, you just can't have it. Because you will have one side, perhaps, that is clinging to, as in the case in the United States, clinging to at least a slight biblical worldview in which we understand there's a right and there's a wrong and there is a God. And yes, he is the God of Scripture, even if it's just tipping your hat to that. And then you have the other side taking God completely out of its platform. No, we don't want anything to do with God. When God's name is mentioned at our convention, we're going to boo him. And let's be the culture of death on steroids and abortion on demand. And we're going to redefine marriage and we're going to riot in the streets. And then we're going to call the other side uncivil. Where does it end? We talk sometimes about, well, maybe it ends with street violence. Maybe it ends with civil war. Maybe it ends with people being assassinated. Maybe, but it doesn't end well unless there's repentance. It doesn't end well unless we recognize that we need the Lord again. And that's what I'm really praying for, because this can't be solved by people going to the polls. All we're going to get when we go to the polls, and by the way, everybody should go to the polls. I voted today. Everybody should go to the polls, but that will not cure what ails us, because what ails us is so much deeper than just political. And that's the truth. And I think sometimes we need to pause and talk about that. Here we have Schumer and Pelosi rejecting the president's call for unity as insufficient, saying that his words ring hollow. I mean, how do you win this? How do you bring a country together when you have the top leaders in the opposition party criticizing the president for calling for unity because he didn't call for unity well enough? I mean, that's just a side that doesn't want unity. It's really tearing the country apart. Now, listen to this. MSNBC brought on a Hillary Clinton aide to blame Trump for the mail bombs. Listen to cut four.
Well, look, obviously, someone who sends bombs in the mail or in any way delivers or tries to hurt people isn't a sane or good person. So don't want to ascribe to them any kind of higher political strategy of affecting midterms. But I think your larger point is correct in that, you know, irrespective of what this person's political leanings or motivations are, we are living in an atmosphere where hate and violence have been not only incited, but condoned by Donald Trump. And look, you know, this could be the most liberal person in America who has some problem with these four individuals and institutions. It doesn't really matter. Excuse me. There are a lot of people who are living on the edge of sanity in general. I don't mean that to be facetious. And when people in authority kind of lift the guardrails from that, people are going to act out. And there is no human being more responsible for the climate we're in than Donald Trump. Today is the 643rd day he has been in office. I don't think he has uttered a single word on any of those days that in any way condemns violence or tells people to dial it down. He thrives on it. He requires it. He cannot succeed without hate and anger. He, for him to say everyone should dial it back would basically be him acknowledging and raising a white flag. And it's absolutely horrible.
Okay. All right. A former Hillary Clinton aide talking about how horrible Trump is and how much hate and violence is condoned by Donald Trump. Well, let's go back to Hillary Clinton, shall we? This is just from a few weeks ago. You'll recall this when she was talking to Christiana Amanpour and talking about the issue of civility. This is cut five.
You cannot be civil with a political party that wants to destroy what you stand for, what you care about. That's why I believe if we are fortunate enough to win back the House and or the Senate, that's when civility can start again. But until then, the only thing that the Republicans seem to recognize and respect is strength.
Oh, brother. That's nice. That's a terrific setup. So we don't want to be civil, but if you give us all the power, that's when civility can come back. Does anybody believe that? As long as we're in charge, things will be civil. Oh, well, I recall that you were in charge under Barack Obama, and I don't recall it being that civil at all. At all. But this is incredible. This is what this same woman had to say yesterday. This is Cut 6.
Many of you and others across our country have asked after me and my family, and I'm very grateful for that. We are fine, thanks to the men and women of the Secret Service who intercepted the package addressed to us long before it made its way to our home. Every day, we are grateful for their service and commitment, and obviously never more than today. But it is a troubling time, isn't it? And it's a time of deep divisions, and we have to do everything we can to bring our country together.
Okay, well, if I take that in the context of the previous cut, then I would have to understand that as saying, once Democrats are completely in charge of this country, that's how we bring people together. Give us all the power and elect Hillary Clinton president, and everything will be rosy. Absolutely terrific. You know, we don't have memories that are that short, unfortunately, for Hillary Clinton. And I think if the left really believes in civility, then it needs to be demonstrating civility, demonstrating it. Not to mention the question of who really was behind it. And there are plenty of people on the right who are saying, I'm not so sure that this whole mail bomb scare was on the up and up anyway. I have no idea. I leave it to the federal authorities to do a thorough investigation. That's appropriate. I wouldn't jump to conclusions about it, but the political context in which we're all living is not a good one, and we need to pray for this country. There's no doubt about it. And by the way, I just want to reiterate how grateful I am that we are able to concentrate on what matters. And one of the ways you can do that is by helping us support the great work of Heart for Lebanon. I've been telling you a lot about Heart for Lebanon. We've done wonderful work with them in the past. You guys have been so generous. But you know what? This is what life is all about. People who have never heard about Jesus Christ ever, have never heard the gospel of Jesus Christ, are living in very, very tough conditions. These refugees who are living in Lebanon right now, mostly children who are being recruited by Islamic radicals who have lost their fathers, many of them, in the Syrian civil war. And Heart for Lebanon is on the ground, and they're sharing the gospel with these kids, and they're sharing the gospel with their parents, and they are getting them a Christian education and food to eat. It is a tremendous ministry. We need your help, though. If you can give a gift of $22, you will help rescue four of these children and give them an entire day of care at Heart for Lebanon's Hope Center. Here's the number to call. 866-485-9187, 866-485-9187. And if you can go to janetmefford.com, there's a banner to click. It's just an incredible Christian missionary outreach. There's no better way to say it, and we need your help. So please pray about it, and please give if you can as we're continuing on. We're about halfway toward our goal, but we need you today. 866-485-9187. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you so much for your support. We'll be right back. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is brought to you by Graceworks Pictures Indivisible, based on the true story of Army Chaplain Darren Turner and his wife Heather. Indivisible, rated PG-13, may be inappropriate for children under 13. In theaters October 26th, more information is available at indivisiblemovie.com. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. Well, an administrator in the Office of Management and Budget recently hailed the efforts of President Trump to rein in the administrative state, noting that over the past 2 years, federal agencies have reduced regulatory costs by $23 billion and eliminated hundreds of burdensome regulations. But why does the administrative state have so much power in the first place? And what more can and should be done to rein these agencies in? We're going to talk about it today with Peter J. Wallison, who holds the Arthur F. Burns Chair in Financial Financial Policy Studies and is co-director of the American Enterprise Institute's program on financial policy studies. His book is called Judicial Fortitude, The Last Chance to Rein in the Administrative State. Peter, it's great to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, it's nice to have you here to explain to a lot of us who are not experts on the administrative state why it is the state of affairs is what it is. How would you characterize the administrative state's power at the moment? We've seen a lot about the president dealing with out of control regulations and that sort of thing. But what is the status as it stands right now?
Well, I think the president has succeeded in reducing it somewhat. But although you mentioned in your discussion that perhaps they've reduced the administrative state's impact on the economy by $23 billion, some of the estimates are that the regulations in the economy today amount to about $2 trillion.
Ooh.
So we have a long, long way to go.
Yes.
How do they acquire so much power really is the question. And I think the reason is that the courts have failed in the duty that they were supposed to discharge under the Constitution. And that's a tough thing to say. It's hard for many people to understand. But when the framers set up our Constitution, they set up a separation of powers with the Congress supposed to make all the laws, the executive supposed to enforce the laws, and of course the judiciary was to interpret the laws, but they were also supposed to make sure that this separation of powers was kept.
Yes.
And was preserved.
Yes.
And that's what they have failed to do. They have, over time, primarily since the New Deal, so it's continued almost for 75 years, they have failed to rein in the growth of the administrative state when they had the power to do so. And in fact, in many ways, they've enhanced the power of the administrative state during that period.
It's crazy. Well, you talk about the New Deal, I know, and you discuss how the New Deal really opened the door for all of this power in the administrative state. And then it was really, as you mentioned, culminating in this decision by the Supreme Court in 1984. You talk about the Chevron Doctrine. Can you explain what that's all about and how the Chevron Doctrine really has exacerbated the problem?
Yes. Well, what the framers had in mind, of course, was that the courts would interpret the statutes and they would interpret the powers of administrative agencies under those statutes. But in 1984, the Supreme Court decided to direct the lower courts of the federal judiciary to defer to the decisions of administrative agencies about the powers that they thought they were given by Congress.
Mm.
So in other words, they're the judges, in effect, the agencies are the judges in their own case.
Wow.
When they look at their statutory powers and they think there's something they can do, a new rule or regulation they can put out, if they believe that they have the power to do it, the courts are supposed to defer to that decision of the agencies. So that, of course, is what started this whole process. It was in 1984. There were lots of agencies already established under the New Deal. But generally, up to that point, the courts interpreted statutes and decided whether the agency really had the power that they were asserting.
Good grief.
But in this Chevron case, as I said, the Supreme Court told the lower courts, you defer to the decisions of these agencies about their powers. And so from 1993 on, in every year, we have had more than 3,000 rules and regulations coming out of the agencies for a total of over 101,000 rules and regulations in 25 years. So it's got to be brought under control. And my view is that the only way we will effectively do this is for the courts to return to a position where they are interpreting the statutes. In other words, eliminate the Chevron case or substantially modify it and let the courts decide whether the agencies have really got the powers they're asserting.
No, absolutely. It's interesting to me when you talk about this 1984 Supreme Court case, because knowing the separation of powers, this is a basic building block of the United States and our history and our framework of operation. How is it that the Supreme Court ruled in that manner and you know, deferred to these administrative agencies' interpretations of their authority, when in fact that would be a violation of the separation of powers, right? The president should have the ultimate in the executive branch, have some more power over the administrative state than he does.
Yes, well, absolutely. That it was it's a very peculiar decision, but it came out of a whole long history, which I summarize in the book.
Right.
The whole idea that executive agencies should have the authority to control and regulate the economy was something that began during something called the Progressive Era,
yes,
between about 1880 and 1920. And then it was in the Depression period, it was really brought to the fore by FDR and the Democrats at that point in power. And they established a whole lot of new agencies, made the government much larger than it ever had been. But the idea that the agencies were staffed by really intelligent, disinterested people who had lots of good credentials and were very capable of regulating the economy, that idea survived in the courts for many years until 1984, when it was finally put into effect by the Supreme Court with that Chevron case, which said, look, the agencies are really smart. They have really good people staffing them. We should allow them to make this decision. They will be better at deciding what Congress really wanted than we, the courts, are.
Oh, boy.
This was a terrible decision.
Yeah.
And we've been living with it ever since. Now, I must say that I am much more optimistic now that Brett Kavanaugh is the fifth member of a group on the Supreme Court who are originalists and who are constitutionalists and I think are determined to roll this back.
Well, right. And that's a really key issue, is the fact that now you have a justice on the Supreme Court who is an avowed originalist. And you had mentioned before, didn't he dissent in a specific case that gave you some hope in this regard as well?
Yes, definitely. In 2015, in a dissent when he was a judge at the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is really the second most important court in the United States. He had been a judge there for about 10 or 13 years, something like that. And in a 2015 case, he said, whenever an agency wants to take a step that is not specifically authorized by its statute, they have to go back to Congress.
Good.
Now, that's exactly the right attitude to take. That would be the opposite of what the court decided in Chevron. So that's one of the things that makes me very optimistic. And it's not only Kavanaugh, but there are now five on the court who have at one time or another taken a position like that, including the other appointment by President Trump, and that's Neil Gorsuch.
Yes, exactly right. And this is why the Supreme Court matters so much. But as you're saying in your book, Judicial Fortitude, that's what's really needed, because it is the last chance to rein in the administrative state. One of the things I want to get into when we come back is the issue of the judiciary failing in its responsibility, but also moving toward the idea that a case could potentially come before the Supreme Court again and do more in this regard, taking advantage of the five justices that are originalists. We're going to come back. Peter J. Wallison, my guest. His book is called Judicial Fortitude. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. Imagine what it would be like if America were decimated by a civil war and millions of us had to flee for our lives. Imagine living in a crowded tent city with very little to eat, no education for your kids, and the threat of Islamic radicalization and sex trafficking all around you. Well, that's been the situation in Lebanon for several years now. In fact, 2 million of these refugees are living in tent cities in Lebanon, but there, they're finding the hope of Jesus Christ. That's been the situation because of our wonderful ministry partner, Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is there among the refugees right now, offering the gospel of Jesus Christ, food to eat, and a Christian education for the many, many children who are in great need. At Heart for Lebanon's Hope Centers, little children like John are learning to read, getting nutritious meals, and hearing the good news that Jesus is his Savior. Not only are these children coming to know the Lord, but so are their parents. And when they go back home, they'll be taking the gospel with them to parts of the Middle East that many of us could never reach. Your gift of $22 will bring a day of food and Christ-centered education to 4 of these refugee children, while a gift of $98 will feed and educate an entire classroom full of children. That's 18 children for 1 entire day. We really need your help right now, so we're asking, call right now, 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Let's help create the next great Christian missionary force. The Lord is working in the hearts of refugee children in Lebanon, but we need your financial help. 866-485-9187. Again, your gift of $22 will bring a day of food and Christ-centered education to 4 refugee children. Please call now, 866-485-9187, 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Great to have you with us, and great to have with us Peter Wallison. He is with the American Enterprise Institute's Program on Financial Policy Studies, where he serves as co-director. His book is called Judicial Fortitude, The Last Chance to Rein in the Administrative State. We were discussing before we went to the break, Peter, the fact that now that we have Justice Kavanaugh, an originalist on the Supreme Court, you have 5 justices who are originalists, that this may give us some hope for reining in the administrative state. But are there any pending cases that may be headed toward the Supreme Court where they would even take up the question?
Well, yeah, there is actually one case that has already come before the court, which is a very interesting one, and might actually start the court down the right road. Now, unfortunately, because of all the disputes at the time he was nominated, Kavanaugh was not able to sit for that case. But there were 8 justices on the court at that time. I attended the argument, and it seemed to me that there might have been 5 of them even then who were willing to take a major step. And the major step is somewhat different from the Chevron issue. It's the question of whether Congress has delegated legislative authority to the president. As we were talking about before, there's a separation of powers in the Constitution. Congress is supposed to make the laws, and the executive is only supposed to implement the laws, administer the laws. But what has been happening over time is that Congress has been granting more and more power to the president and to the administrative agencies.
Yes.
The effect of that, as many lawyers have thought for many years, and I certainly have, is that this is a violation of the Constitution. They're no longer making the laws. The administrative agencies are really making the laws because Congress has delegated to them some of its legislative power. And that's a violation of the Constitution. So if the courts are willing to step in there, they can also prevent lots of delegation of legislative power to the executive branch by calling it what it is, which is a violation of the Constitution. On October 2, the court heard a case in which someone complained that he had been accused of violating the law because the attorney general had held that he was a law breaker. And a certain area, it happened to be the violation of some of the laws relating to children, how children are dealt with by adults. And the law that Congress passed said the Attorney General shall decide whether certain kinds of activities are a violation of law and shall impose the punishment. Now, most people who would think about that, especially in a criminal law context, would say, well, wait a minute. You can't tell the Attorney General to not only decide whether the law has been broken, which is one thing, and the punishment, but also whether the law has been, whether the person has violated the law at all,
right.
Whether there is a law that governs the person's conduct. And so that case, the so-called Gundy case, I think is a case that might start to establish a very important principle that the courts have not been following for the last 200 years.
Yeah.
And that is that when Congress delegates authority to the executive branch, that authority cannot include the authority to make laws, only to implement laws.
That's good.
And so we have a chance here when the decision in the Gundy case comes down for the court, for the first time really since the New Deal, to establish the idea that Congress can go too far in delegating authority to the executive branch.
That would be great. I hope that happens. What about reducing the bloat and getting rid of some of these administrative agencies and reducing the size of government and reducing the size of the administrative state? How plausible is that?
Well, it's plausible, but very, very difficult to do because that would require actions of Congress.
Yeah.
And one of the problems here is that Congress has been very weak. Congress has weakened itself. Congress has not stepped up to do the things that the Constitution required it to do. As I said before, it's delegating authority to the executive branch instead of making these decisions itself.
Yes.
Because they're afraid in many cases to take the political steps that would cause controversy and cause them to lose their jobs in the next election. So they have been avoiding these responsibilities. Now to ask them to cut back on agencies would be very tough to do.
Yeah,
it might happen, but people have to keep in mind they have to vote for Congress people who are actually willing to take that major step. And most are not willing to go that far.
Well, and that's a shame because, as you mentioned, that's not what the founders had in mind. The Congress does have to pass laws and the Congress does have to take the bull by the horns and it has to do its job. And I think that's very frustrating to a lot of American people. We elect you guys to go up to the Beltway and get things done. And you don't get things done because you're too worried about being reelected. Is it the case that the judiciary can do enough where the weakness of Congress will maybe be not papered over, but maybe be not as important? It is important for them not to be weak, clearly. But in other words, can the judiciary do enough on this issue, like on this case that you mentioned, the Gundy case, to fix the problem sufficiently? In other words, can the
Yes.
judiciary alone do it well?
I think it can. And in fact, if the judiciary acts the right way here, if the judiciary says, no, you cannot delegate this authority to an administrative agency, and they declare the law unconstitutional, that will force Congress to make these tough decisions itself.
Okay.
Because what will happen in the future then is that people will go to Congress to get these things resolved. They won't go to the courts and they won't go to the agencies. They will go to Congress. And that's the way it was supposed to be under the Constitution.
Yes.
Congress is supposed to make these rules.
Yes.
But once they started delegating their authority to the executive branch, well, then people ran to the agencies and tried to get something from the agencies, or they brought cases before the courts to try to get something from the courts. All of that is wrong.
Yeah.
The courts ought to say Congress should make this decision. And when they do that, people will go to Congress and Congress will have to start making these tough calls.
Yeah.
That's the way the system is supposed to work.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, one irony that stands out to me is the fact that the founders, the whole reason for the separation of powers is they didn't want one branch of government to have too much power because they understood how power can be corrupted. I mean, they fully understood the nature of man. And yet you have, it seems, in the Chevron doctrine that you mentioned, oh, these are good people in the administrative state. I can't imagine the founders saying, wait a minute, No, you guys have it all wrong. Don't assume that anybody's going to be a great, great guy. He's going to do all the right things. You don't have anything to worry about. Clearly, we did have something to worry about.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you go back and look at the book and my chapter on the progressive era, you find that Woodrow Wilson, who was the leader of the progressives at that time, really wanted to modify the Constitution.
Yeah.
Because he didn't want the Constitution, the Congress, to be making the laws. He wanted the executive branch. He wanted executive agencies run by really smart, well-motivated people to be making the rules. And when you think about it, that isn't at all a democracy. That's nothing like a democracy. And the first line in my book is that our democracy is in danger if we can't get control of the administrative state. And that is because what it means to have these agencies making all of these decisions is that the priorities of these people in Washington, D.C. become the priorities of the people of the entire United States.
That's right.
And we know that that's wrong. Yes. That's not a democracy.
No, it's not. And we saw some of that same, same action under the Obama administration, where you had, different decisions being made and the idea that the executive branch should have more power and these sorts of things. And it would go the other way if you have progressive control of Congress and the executive branch in the future. We'll get the same thing again, it would seem.
Sure, because the progressives actually like the decisions and priorities of the people who live in the Washington area.
Yes.
The government employees and officials, they like that. But that's not the country. That isn't the United States. And in the book, I talk about what happened in the EU with Brexit. You remember that in 2016,
yes,
the British people voted to remove themselves from the EU for exactly the reason that all these regulations were being made by the EU and imposed on them in England without any involvement of the people here,
yes,
in England.
That's right.
So we're looking at about the same thing going on here in the United States. And unless we stop it, we're going to have a loss of legitimacy by our own government.
Well, that's right. Well, it's a great book, Judicial Fortitude, The Last Chance to Rein in the Administrative State, by Peter Wallace and my guest. Peter, so good to have you here. Really appreciate your being with us.
Thanks for your time.
All right. Take care. Thank you very, very much. And thanks for tuning in to Janet Meffer today. We'll see you next time.